Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Monday. It's January 27th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We've got a nice panel of guests today, as we always do on Monday. We begin the morning with John Bailey, who is the White Plains Citizenet reporter, publisher, and editor, as well as the Monday co-host of Westchester on the Level. And we're going to talk to him about Greenburg, the town of Greenburg, as well as the agenda that's slated for the White Plains Common Council this week. And then at 10:30, we're going to speak to none other than the political pundit or analyst, Michael Edelman. So he'll be on from 10:30 to 11. And then I'll be with you after 11 o'clock. So I guess that's where we are today. There's a lot of stuff happening, certainly. The president is involved in so many things, so we'll have to ask Michael Edelman about what's going on with negotiations about the deal of the century, and just so many other things with regard to the Senate hearings as well. And we'll just see where we end up. So I guess the thing that was really most interesting to me, I've gotten a notice from Greenburg Town Supervisor Paul Feiner last week. And he had mentioned that there was another accident in Greenburg. And unfortunately, people are traveling too fast on the roads and not as being as cautious as they should. And there were 8 incidences in this past year of people getting hit by a car. And one of the things that they've been doing, even though it's a limited budget, they've been building sidewalks wherever they can, because they didn't have as many as one would think. It's a town, but it's sprawling and growing. And I just see that John Bailey just got on the line, so let's pull him in. Bear with me a moment. Good morning, John. Pleasure to have you on this morning.
Good morning from White Plains, New York, USA.
Good morning, John. You know, before we begin on what's on the agenda at the White Plains City Common Council, I was wondering if you and I can discuss for a moment the crisis that's taking place in Greenburg. There was an article, or rather a notice that was presented last week by none other than Town Supervisor Paul Feiner. He advised that over the last few months, I think it was up to 8 months, or no, maybe I'm just confusing it, there were 8 accidents on the roads in the town of Greenburg. Why? And he was bringing a question as to why the town doesn't measure up to getting red light cameras, whereas cities are permitted that. Does that make logical sense to you? It didn't make sense to me.
No, it didn't make sense. If you have a heavily accidented road, you have to present the evidence and get a permission to say, like, have traffic lights installed or stop signs. The state has to approve those. So my feeling would be, if you have a heavily accidented road where people are really getting hurt on a rather frequent basis and speed is often exceeded, you would think that they would go along with that. Another thing is that what might stop it is the idea that the town, there are various towns along that route. And so it'd be a little bit, it's not like within a city, you know, where you're all contained in one city and all the revenue goes to the city. You would have to split the revenue between the various jurisdictions along Route 119, Old Perrytown Road, which is the road we're speaking about. That's just my guess there. That's sort of somewhat the problem. But truly, red light cameras would help things.
You think the problem is disbursement of funds to the different,
I'm just guessing.
Places?
I'm just guessing.
The real issue, rather than contemplating it, the real issue is that towns don't qualify to put up red light cameras, whereas the city is permitted to. And if both the town as well as the city give validation to the crisis or the issue, such as, you know, people going too fast and so many accidents taking place, whereas they would approve it for a city, they do not approve anything like that to a town. And that's what I don't understand.
Well, the situation is that the road is dangerous because it's wide, there are not very well-marked crossings, and people jaywalk.
Right, and they're also that whole road is not all paved with sidewalks. So they are investing money in sidewalks, but it's a limited budget as well.
Well, it's part of the whole infrastructure problem, and the lack of enforcement by police forces of speed limits.
That's very true.
I mean, the accident that happened on Friday at noon that brought up this latest venture on the part of Mr. Flanner to get something to be done was the gentleman was crossing in the sidewalk and a truck apparently ran the red light.
Yeah.
And then fled the car. They're still looking for him, I think.
Right.
But
it's totally insanity.
Yes. But it was a quite busy intersection. And if you slow down traffic on that road, which it's going to be a bottleneck. It's a very major thoroughfare cross county at the mid-county mark. Other than
the
expressway.
Are you suggesting that the bottleneck is more important than the safety of people trying to cross the street?
Well, it's not, because there is an effort to transform that road, if you recall, Share the Streets movement, which would narrow lanage on the road, have more crosswalks, overpass crossings. And that has
been great.
Pooh-poohed by some commentators, such as myself, about how that is really going to slow up traffic. I have said that, but I had no idea they were having so many accidents. But I think it's the impatient driving, people getting in a hurry, and the bottleneck on cross Westchester Expressway 287, eastbound and westbound in rush hours.
Right. Yeah, that's the biggest probably instigator of all of this.
Yeah, people divert.
People want to travel like on highway speed. crazy.
And you're only supposed to go 30 on Route 119, but people routinely go 40 and 45 miles
amazing.
An hour. So,
well,
and
John,
when you're going that fast,
time
you can't
is always
stop.
Short.
Yeah.
Time is always short, but at the end of the day, we've got a very important issue, and that's the special meeting that was called for tomorrow by the Common Council in White Plains. They got a lot on their plate. One of the issues they want to discuss is solar panels for city facilities. Is that an expensive effort?
Well, the effort is that the city would make city-owned buildings available for rooftop space available for installation of solar panels, and the city would participate in the electricity generated by those solar panels.
Well, so in a sense, it would be like a moneymaker as well.
In theory, and I believe the idea, it's been a while since we've discussed this, the idea is that the solar panels would be installed free, no city expense.
That's fantastic. Wow.
It is a good idea.
So that's coming up for discussion tomorrow?
Yes. I think they are
definitely. It should be a slam dunk, no?
One would think, yes. But we have to see what the details are and who wants to actually do this. They should also look at that as for private facilities and new buildings that are being built. I mean, for example, we got 55 Bank Street going up. We have apartment complex on Post and Mamaroneck that has started to go up, and they should really put solar panels on the top of those buildings. Please.
That's really a great idea, John, because then
nobody has ever spoken
that
about that.
Well, if they incorporate that money from solar panels in a private building should also revert back to the city, because that can compensate for some of the incentives that are forked over at the front end, and this way it'll be repetitive for the city overall.
Yes.
So they might be able to get some of that money back, and they need the money up front. So I think it's a good deal. Well, I wanted to ask you about this other thing, which I haven't heard about in a long time. It was good of you to bring it up, was the 52 North Broadway. There's a zoning petition from Good Counsel. That's a property known as Good Counsel. Why do they want a zoning petition now? Why don't they tell us this in the beginning? I'm always confused by that.
This is a really good question, because as you know, in White Plains, New York, USA, everything happens in secret. Everything.
Yes.
And then they schedule a special meeting a week before the actual real Common Council meeting, where they pass things in public, and they tell the council what they want to do. And the council basically agrees in these special meetings, and the public has absolutely no input.
I didn't realize, John, you're saying that a special meeting is a closed meeting and that the public has no awareness of what goes on there, and then
It's not closed.
But
it is not closed. What it is, it's a special meeting, usually called about 24 hours in advance, as it was Friday night, and scheduled. And so therefore, if you're not looking at the CitizenNet Reporter website or deep into the city website, you don't know about it.
Right. You wouldn't expect
that
because it's unexpected.
Yeah. But you don't have a chance to weigh in. You don't have a chance to weigh in.
And how does one weigh in on this?
Well,
because you're unaware. Is that what you mean?
That's right. You're unaware. Right.
Oh,
if you're not aware of it, you can't say, hey, wait a minute. Now, this goes back to a development that is currently in controversy, because the neighbors around the 52 North Broadway site claim that there is a lot of toxic debris underneath the surface on the southern side of the property that the developer should have to clean up. And the Department of Environmental Conservation was reviewing whether or not it should be cleaned up, but we do not know whether or not they have made a decision on that. Again, the city isn't going to tell you. They never do.
But isn't cleanup usually known as brownfield? Isn't there funding from the state? But they have to validate that it needs to be mitigated, so either it is or it isn't. But that has nothing to do with the zoning petition, does it?
Well, that's what's so unusual about it. Maybe I have no idea what the zoning petition could possibly be, but if they're discussing it at a special meeting, it usually has some major impact on a property.
Well, thank goodness you could sniff all these issues out because you're so familiar with the conduct of the Common Council.
No, I just know my city. I know the city cold. They don't tell you what they're doing. They never tell you the truth about anything. And it is really bothersome to me as a citizen, just like Washington.
Yeah.
In fact, the Roach administration set the model for the Trump administration in their secrecy.
good point. Very good point. You know, I had no idea, John, that White Plains suffers from the same sort of, standoffish position with the public as well as the media as they do in Yonkers. So I had no idea. It seems like you even having a tougher time than I am.
This has always been the case. I've been doing this website for 20 years, and I've never seen the city hold a press conference and introduce a developer and basically make it available right up front, well in advance of when they would expect to have a site plan put out or whatever. They've never done that.
It's always done in a work session. Yeah, exactly. It's always done in a work session,
and no one knows about it unless the neighbors, who are conveniently informed by the administration. But it's disturbing. What they often do is they sell a concept by going to a neighborhood association first and ego stroking the leaders, making them feel they're important, that they pay attention to it. This is a strategy. And
we use that in Yonkers too. Same concept.
Yes, exactly. And that's neighborhood associations are perhaps some of the weaker organizations in leadership, because they like being hobnobbing with the power of the city, and this is their weakness.
Yeah, it is,
because they don't like to say no. Yes,
exactly.
And, so we eagerly await. I may actually have to drag myself to this meeting and figure out what it's all about. I'll tell you another thing that's interesting. Here's an example of the city in action. Back on January 10th at the Common Council, at a Common Council situation, back in the first meeting of the year when they swore in the new council members. I didn't go because I wanted to get some good shots of them being sworn in. So I watched it from home and took pictures and recorded their speeches so I could get it on that evening. So it would be a pleasant thing for them, perhaps the most pleasant moment of their common council careers.
Right.
Exactly. So I didn't see the idea that the site plan for the White Plains Mall construction of a tremendous complex of 800 apartments, a small park, and retail, a site plan was let go past the time when it expired.
Oh, my God.
So this apparently... Well, the Journal News wrote a story on it saying the site plan had... been let go, and they interviewed the head of Streetworks Design, I believe, who said that, we let it go because we're just so busy. Now, is that the worst? Is that the worst statement ever made by a leader of a company about why they didn't do something?
Absolutely.
We're too busy because you're the the capital city of the county. This is a keystone development that the city has been touting for years, and you can't get it done?
It's amazing that they...
It is amazing. I tell you, I would say, look, don't bother.
I'd be embarrassed.
We're going to condemn your property and develop ourselves.
Exactly.
You're talking about eminent domaining, part of East Post Road, for... to help out the White Plains Hospital grow, a tax-exempt organization, which basically is a very good hospital, but I don't think hospitals should be tax-exempt. They steal money from the government.
They steal
money from the government by overinflating their Medicaid bills.
That's a known fact.
Known fact. In fact, the governor is going to try and take aim at that, and I wish he would. But nobody ever talks about auditing hospitals. But I digress.
No,
so therefore,
no, they don't.
We now wait for this key signature development that White Blazers have been touting for 3-4 years now,
mm-hmm.
for them to have to submit a new site plan. And what are they going to do? It's going to
no
take
no clue.
I know, and the city's major domo, John Callahan, was quoted in the paper saying, "Well, extensions of site plans are rather normal and all that, and 3 to 4 years." Well, that's the problem. They shouldn't be normal.
Mm-hmm.
That's
very true.
Development has to be built in a timely manner. Would you not agree? Otherwise, you miss the opportunity and you become last in the market with too much.
Well, the cities don't put a time frame on it. If you are ready to go when we approve it, then you have to be ready to go. You better get started in 6 months' time.
Or you pay penalty. Don't give them tax credits. You give tax stations if you don't do it on time. And if they don't have their financing lined up for the project at the time when it's approved, that's tough.
There's also a penalty. There's a penalty for that, too, in case you can't get approval. Then why are you bothering to take hold of the property that maybe somebody else can develop right away?
Yes, this is an insidious plan of basically developers. What they do is they use other people's money to create an asset.
Right.
An asset that has an approved site plan attached to it, you can sell for a tremendous profit.
Mm-hmm. Very true. I wanted to ask you as well, what about the Hope AME Zion Church government use permit? Is that a real problem? Do they not have that permit?
I don't think. Well, that's another case in point. That was approved years ago. They haven't started it yet. This is the pattern. If you recall, Mr. Capelli started to try to develop in Yonkers, but he developed first in White Plains. And when he got approval, he set right to work, built it in 2 years, the city center, and then he built the Ritz-Carlton complex and condos in another 2 years. Four huge buildings in four years.
No, that was terrific, but in
that's
Yonkers,
unheard of now.
Capelli, but in Yonkers, Capelli the city allowed him to hang around for 12 years and nothing happened. There was talk about it. It was supposed to be a $2 billion project, and nothing happened with the Chicken Island proposal.
Yeah. That's a Chicken Island proposal.
Sold. It was more than Chicken Island. The Chicken Island, the waterfront, the whole area, and nothing ever came of it. Waste of time and money.
What about the
capital project for the Gilley Park improvement? Is that wanting as well? Or just as an upgrade?
No, I mean, that is, I think that's somewhat of a minor project.
Uh-huh.
Because that is up by Ferris Avenue, I believe. Or is it Gilley? No, wait.
Gilley
My Park. Mind is failing me here. I think Gilley Field is down off of Merrick Avenue. And so we'll have to see what they have in mind for that. But there is another indication that hasn't been presented. This will be the first time it's presented, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Wow.
And,
what's the rationale?
But I mean, this is what happens.
What's the rationale for scheduling user fees for recreation and parks? Is everything going up in price everywhere we go?
Well, yes.
People are challenged financially.
Well, it costs money to run these programs, and it will cost more every year. So they always have to up the recreation fees each year. They always do. It's basically an inflation. It's an inflation. It is not at all compared to Con Edison rates.
Right, exactly.
Exactly.
But
it's
a necessary evil because we need to keep up with, you know, the whole facility, need to keep it up to date and valid. And then I guess it does cost more because even people get paid a little bit more over time. At least I hope so. Oh, my gosh.
Meanwhile, we are on the verge.
Are expected to attend.
Yes.
We're on the verge of what?
We're on the verge of an exoneration of President Trump.
Yeah, you never know. But now that they, with President Trump, Bolton wrote a book, which evidently the president was aware of. It's not going to be published, I think, until March. But the basic outline of the book was presented to the president in December. So it really puts into question whether the president was actually aware of.
Trump
aware
doesn't
because he instigated
read.
The cost. He wanted to get Ukraine to fork over information about Biden, and that is part of the book. So the president said, no, I didn't do it, but Bolton wrote the book already, and it hasn't been published yet, but it will be. So it actually puts into question the integrity of the president's recollection. It's a real problem.
Well, he
not that
he
won't
is,
win. He still won't get impeached, but, you know, that's not the issue.
Yes.
It might be for some people because they want him out. But
it is time for women Republicans to stand up against him. I don't want to hear how wonderful the Republican women senators are who are going to vote for this guy to be let go.
Well, that's
I don't want to hear
how
from
many
them.
How many Republicans need to change their vote against the president in order for the impeachment process to take hold? Was that only four?
Four
need to switch their vote.
Yes, it's has to be a straight turn down. It can be as little as one vote, because that's what happened to Andrew Johnson in 1868. Which is a very similar case.
You remember those days?
I do. But, I mean, that was the first impeachment process, and people should go up and look at that case. It's very similar to today's case against Trump. In fact, it's almost an absolute replica, and the effect of that, according to a book called The American President, is that it said that a president cannot be impeached for policies that are not liked.
I gotcha. Okay.
A very,
very
huge
good point.
Difference, but it's also very similar. The reason the Democrats want to get rid of Trump is they don't like his policies.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's
that.
Really.
And so that's why.
Right.
Yeah. What's intriguing about the whole question is that this case has not been talked about by any commentators that I can see in the press or on TV, for that matter. Nobody brings up the first impeachment. Very similar. You had Andrew Johnson, a Southern sympathizer. The Democrats wanted to, you know, reform the South and support the blacks and the black slaves that were freed and Andrew Johnson did not fund the Freedman's Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they didn't like him. It was a straight policy difference. And one vote decided it in favor of Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson allowed wholesale killing of Negroes after the Civil War. He allowed it. Did not stop
Very
it.
Very true.
And so,
listen,
therefore,
I unfortunately,
that's it.
What? Yeah.
That's what they should be looking at. So if they disapprove of if they exonerate Trump, it would be consistent with that decision.
I hear you. Brilliant concept. John, unfortunately, we have to say goodbye. So what a great way to start a Monday with you. Thank you very, very much. So people should go to the White Plains Citizenet Reporter or WPCNR.com, and they could read the work, the fine work of John Bailey, the publisher and editor of White Plains Citizenet Reporter. Thank you, John.
Okay. So long for now, everyone.
All the best. Be well. Bye. All right, so we're going to move on in a moment. We're going to be speaking with none other than Michael Edelman. I see he's already on the line, so we'll try to pull him in. Good morning, Mr. Edelman. What a pleasure to have you on this morning.
Good morning, Hezzy. Just a little advanced warning. I'm going to have to stop a little before 11 because I have a doctor's appointment.
No problem. We'll try to keep it short as it is. Well, today's a big day. Evidently, the president, I think it's actually tomorrow, he's going to be seeing or revealing the deal of the century that he's been able to put together with Jared Kushner and stuff that's supposed to be the deal to resolve the issue in the Middle East with Israel and the Palestinians.
Really?
How do you see that?
It's a bunch of BS. Designed to reelect Benjamin Netanyahu and the right-wing Likud, you can't have a deal that's imposed on the parties. The King of Jordan has already said he's going to reject it. Abbas, on the behalf of the Palestinians, said he's going to be. How do you not negotiate a deal? How do you just announce a deal?
Well, that's a question. The president didn't know that Netanyahu would be challenged. Is this just an excuse that he's coming up with now? But he did actually invite Netanyahu and didn't invite his opposition candidate that was running against Netanyahu, and that's Benny Gantz. But he's now also been invited. But originally, Gantz wasn't even going to bother to show up. So.
Yeah, but it's not possible to have a deal in that part of the world without active participation from everybody who's involved. The Palestinians,
I agree.
Jordan, anybody who's got any skin in the game has got to be at the table to configure something that's acceptable to everybody. This is nonsense. You don't reveal a deal because your son-in-law happens to be Jewish. Every single one of the negotiators is Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't one Arab in there. There isn't one member of a Mideastern government or an envoy in there. It's all American Jews. It's nonsense. It's to distract from impeachment.
Is that really what it is? That's what it's all about now.
Of course. Now
and what about
Bolton,
this whole thing with – I wanted to ask you about Bolton because that's also part of this whole process of because Bolton wrote a book, which isn't published yet. It's going to be published in March.
Yep.
But evidently the work that he put into the writing of the book was presented to the president in December.
Well, the book has to be presented to the White House, not to the president, because they have to review it for classified information.
Okay. So in that Bolton says that $391 million of aid to Ukraine requested or actually demanded that the Ukraine president, Zelensky, fork over information on Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter. So evidently the president knew what he was doing.
Well, of course he did. This is not what it – the Republicans have been arguing that there's no nexus between the president and the request by Giuliani and others – that Zelensky announced an investigation into the Bidens. Well, everybody knows that there's no way anybody would be acting without the president's assent. And so that defense is going to fall flat on its face Republican senators better now call for John Bolton to testify. If they don't, they'll be historically known as part of the cover-up, okay? Because it's perfectly clear now. Gordon Sondland, our ambassador to the EU, testified that it was a quid pro quo. Somebody overheard Sondland on the phone with Trump from a restaurant.
Right.
Asking about the big stuff, in other words, the investigation. He knew about it. He ordered it. And he did it because he believes Fox News conspiracy theories that the DNC server was in Ukraine and that Ukraine, not Russia, intervened in the 2016 election, all of which is untrue, all of which has been debunked. All of which his own National Homeland Security advisor, Tom Bossert, said was foolish and nonsense. But Donald Trump believed it. And that's why Lindsey Graham is saying, well, Trump in his mind believed he was doing nothing wrong. All right, so I'm going to rob a bank. But in my mind, I believe that I'm doing nothing wrong. And that excuses my bank robbery. Really?
I've heard that argument from many different places. It's getting insane. It's getting tiring also to hear that. Absolutely. That was that case in Mount Vernon. The Inspector General, the Corporation Counsel in Mount Vernon actually took, don't remember what the figure was. Oh, yeah, I think about $325,000 out of the water department, which he could,
he
turned it over to the former mayor because the mayor needed the money to defend himself in a court case as well as to resurrect his reputation. So the lawyer who was the corporation counsel said, I didn't steal anything because I didn't earn any money from it. And they said, we have to get the decision on how that's going to work out. But theft is theft, right? You don't have to put it in your pocket. You're not permitted to steal no matter what. So,
you cannot. My father used to have a little ditty he used to tell me. He who steals what isn't his'n very often goes to prison.
Oh, that's a really perfect. I love that. Excellent. Your father was a brilliant man. Well, I want to ask you about something else, and that's the USA Today and Suffolk University survey on Sunday. They asserted that the Vice President Biden, has a narrow lead in the Iowa caucuses, Mr. Biden is leading. But they came up with numbers, so they say this is a week before the contest. 25% for Biden, Bernie's at 19, Buttigieg is 18, Elizabeth Warren at 13, undecided with about 13. The point is the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries, the caucus and then the primary in New Hampshire, they're suggesting now that these should not be the first and beginning places for these contests because they're older.
No.
They're white.
Yep.
And
correct.
And so there's something wrong with it because it's not their populations don't represent the nation. And somebody suggested, why don't we turn it around? Well, that's
another
thing,
too. They don't represent the Democratic Party.
Iowa
and New Hampshire are not going to be relevant this year. And let me tell you why. Because there's not going to be a clear statistical winner in Iowa. They'll all be bunched up. It doesn't make a difference.
Uh-huh.
The way the caucuses work is they do it, I believe, by election district or by congressional district, and they all show up at a house or a school or a firehouse, and they stand in a corner for their candidate. Everybody's got a spot. If you don't get 15%, you have to drop that candidate out, and those people are allowed to re-caucus with the people that are already there, right? So we don't know. There's going to be there may be more than one result coming out of Iowa. They may say the preliminary results are, blah, 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 Joe Biden wins. But when everybody broke up, and the 15 less than 15% left, it was Pete Buttigieg. I don't know what's going to happen.
Okay.
It's not relevant because we have a Super Tuesday and South Carolina after New Hampshire. And that is when you're going to see Joe Biden crush everybody else. I personally think that Biden could very well win Iowa, and that it doesn't matter who wins New Hampshire. Bernie can win New Hampshire. He lives in Vermont. Who cares?
Right. Exactly. That's like mind-boggling, actually. And what about
Bernie's
now speculation?
Bernie's like a favorite son in New Hampshire.
Right. Well, there's now conjecture that Bernie has been allowed to get away with a lot of things that he's done similar to his conduct when he was running against Hillary Clinton, and that the same question that they asked Elizabeth Warren were more in her face, and they didn't ask the same question, that they weren't as stern, meaning the reporters, with Bernie Sanders, and they're afraid that he might be able to run away with the election because his numbers might be too great. Is that potentially a possibility?
I don't understand the question, Hezzy, to be honest with you. Bernie Sanders isn't running away with anything because his numbers aren't great
at
all. Yet. Well, who said his numbers are great?
No,
who
I didn't think that they were great. They're saying that there might be – well, they don't – I think they're just speculating that what's happening is that Bernie Sanders – hasn't been getting a tougher challenge by the reporters. They don't ask him the same questions that they asked Elizabeth Warren to validate his programs that are socialist, and he doesn't explain how he's going to pay for it. So they're afraid
that
people
are going to
buy
into it. Yeah, they asked him the other day. They said he was. He couldn't tell anybody how much his Medicare for All program was going to cost. He said,
right,
whatever it
is
it'll cost less than we're spending now.
Yeah, but that's not an answer, is it?
No, that's right. That's not an answer. You're exactly right.
Yeah. Well,
Bernie
not an
Sanders,
appropriate
let me
answer.
Tell you something. The Democratic Party is not a leftist party. There are some people in the party that are very progressive. But most people, most Democrats are center-left Democrats. And they are not going to allow Donald Trump to use the word socialist by nominating Bernie Sanders, who is a Brooklyn Jewish senator who moved to Vermont, which is the most liberal state in the union. They are not going to nominate Bernie Sanders. It's not going to happen. Bernie Sanders people probably have been spreading the rumor, but it's not going to happen.
Uh-huh.
It's simply not going to happen.
Okay. Well, you know, I really question the integrity of his positions, but he's being supported by people like Ocasio-Cortez.
That's a minority of the Democratic Party, big time.
Is it though, or why are they getting so much press though? It makes it sound like
they're
much more formidable than they are.
Yeah, they say outrageous things. If you say outrageous, why did Joe McCarthy get so much press?
Good point.
Remember
Very
Joe McCarthy?
Good point.
Yeah.
I do remember.
Yeah. They sell papers.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything to sell papers.
Well,
yep.
Well, there's another issue that's coming up because I know you're short on time. There was an attack on the Iraqi embassy of the United States embassy in Baghdad in Iraq. So there was one injury that was on Sunday. Initially, they said no. I don't know why they're so quick to say no if they don't really check. But there's also an attack in Afghanistan today.
Mm-hmm.
Are these countries trying to push America out, and will America leave? And yet at the same time, that's what Trump said he wanted to do, to depart.
Well, he didn't want to depart
should
with
America
his tail between
leave?
His legs. America shouldn't leave. So we have commitments around the world and we shouldn't leave. We certainly shouldn't allow anybody to push us out before we've decided to leave. I don't know who did these attacks, Hezzy. I haven't seen any reporting on where the attacks are. More important about the injuries is that when Trump said when Iran retaliated with its missile attack on the barracks, When Trump said nobody was injured, he was wrong. 34 soldiers were evacuated because of trauma, head trauma. So somebody was injured.
Oh, a lot of people were injured.
In other words, Donald Trump was anxious. Donald Trump was anxious not to have a confrontation with Iran. So he lied about the injuries. And then when asked, he said they're only headaches. Can you imagine?
Right. Yeah, I know.
And the head of the Veterans Association demanded an apology when he said he minimized the seriousness of the concussions.
Yeah, and it was insane. It was insane. Well, I remember the first time I really was like, remember when they killed Baghdadi? You had pointed out that the video was just that video with no audio, and yet the president claimed that he heard the Baghdadi whining like a child or whatever. It was so stupid to even say that. One last question before we go, because evidently it's really hitting all over the world. There's this virus that has infected over 3,000 people, and now it's
in
up
China.
To 81 people have died this morning as opposed to 56 yesterday. The thing is, what I never understood, and I found it laughable, when you would come in where they're doing, when they're vetting people who come in through different airports in the United States, they have this machine that can measure the temperature of the people, their body as they walk through the portals to enter. Now it turns out the Chinese say it's the incubation period is about 14 days. And I didn't know it was going to take that long, but I knew that if I was going to get a cold, if I reflected back 2, 3, or 4 days earlier, I was getting sick, and I didn't realize it.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually it was revealed. So what are these part of the optics to try to calm people down? They don't tell us the truth. And, you know, not everybody could figure all this stuff out. Not that it's such a brilliant idea, but, you know, it's.
You know,
why
Harry,
do we
I
do
don't.
This?
I think the problem is that they don't know this coronavirus. They don't know the incubation time. They don't know whether you're asymptomatic prior to showing symptoms and whether it's contagious when you're asymptomatic. They don't know that. The Chinese didn't act quickly enough to stop several million people from leaving Wuhan, which is where the virus broke out. So they're being criticized. The Chinese are being criticized for not acting, quick enough, not acting appropriately to make sure that these people didn't hop on airplanes and go somewhere else. So now they're in lockdown all through China.
They're now in lockdown, but millions of people leave during the lunar holiday, the Lunar New Year.
Right.
So people all over the world. Well, that becomes, I guess, I guess that's the problem, you know, of also realizing these things. What I found interesting is that the stock market opened with a market down 500 points just on this fact alone.
I know
so
that.
People are running scared.
Believe me, I'm aware of that.
But that's an aberration, isn't it? A 500-point drop? That's like... I don't think we've had anything like that in ages.
No, but you have to understand what the market is responding to. The market is responding to the fact that the economies in China and around the world will be severely hurt if this is a pandemic.
Correct. Absolutely.
So 400 points on a 30,000 400 points on a 30,000 market is a percentage and a half. It's not a big deal.
No, it's just optics again. You know, it scares people one way or the other. I don't know why people run in the wrong direction, but it might affect the trade, and that's probably the biggest issue. Well, unfortunately, Michael Edelman, we're at 10 minutes too, so let me let you go so you can get to your doctor on time because you need to be healthy, and that's the most important thing. All the best to you.
Thanks very much for making the time,
as always. All the best. Be well. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. there we have it, folks. Michael Edelman, Esquire, pundit, analyst on the national as well as in the international stage. Just an absolute brilliant mind, that is for sure. So let me just move back to our studio screen and play for you what's happening with the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Well, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, we're going to talk about some news that's really pertinent. Unfortunately, a very, very sad outcome. Basketball legend Kobe Bryant was killed in a helicopter crash. And... he's an 18-time NBA All-Star. He won 5 championships and became one of the greatest basketball players of his generation during a 20-year career with the Los Angeles Lakers. He died in a helicopter crash yesterday. He was only 41 years of age. He died in a helicopter crash near Calabasas, California. A person familiar with the situation told the Associated Press, it was unclear if family members were on the helicopter. The crash happened around 10 o'clock in the morning near about 30 miles northwest of downtown Los Angeles. And a Federal Aviation Administration spokesman, Alan Kenitzer, said it was a Sikorsky S-76, and it was not known what caused the crash. The L.A. Sheriff's Department confirmed 5 dead in the crash, but had not released identities at the time. Bryant lived in south of Los Angeles in coastal Orange County for much of his adult life, and he often used helicopters to save time and avoid Southern California notorious traffic. Even as a player, he often traveled to practices and games by helicopter, and he kept up the practice after retirement as he attended to his business ventures. And turns out it was very foggy, so we couldn't see anything, said Colin Storm, who was in his living room in Calabasas when he heard what sounded like a low-flying airplane or helicopter. But then he said, but when we heard some sputtering and then a boom a short time after or later, the fog cleared a bit and Storm, Colin Storm said he could see smoke rising from the hillside in front of his home. So very, very tragic, that's for sure. And we'll see where all this leads. I don't know why that particular helicopter was permitted to fly, which is very, very interesting. So we'll see what goes on. Talking about another plane crash, evidently the United States and military, the Army specifically, is investigating a mystery plane crash in eastern Afghanistan. Plane crashed in eastern Afghanistan's Ghazni or Hazni province on Monday. That's today, officials said, but it was not immediately clear how many people were on board or if it was a passenger or military jet. And Taliban sources claimed it was a U.S. military aircraft, while American officials said they were still investigating the report. Now, a Taliban spokesman and Afghan journalist affiliated with the militant group says that a U.S. military aircraft crashed in eastern Afghanistan on Monday. Tariq Hasniwal, a journalist in the area, said that he saw the burning aircraft. In an exchange on Twitter, he told the Associated Press news agency that he saw 2 bodies and that the front of the aircraft was badly burned. He added that the aircraft's body and tail was hardly damaged. His information could not be independently verified, though. A Taliban spokesman, Zabihullah Zabihullah Mujahid said a U.S. Air Force plane crashed in the Ghazni province. He claimed the crash killed lots of U.S. service members. Hasniwal said the crash site was about 10 kilometers from a U.S. military base. It's about 3 miles away. 6 miles away. U.S. Major Army Major Beth Reardon, a spokeswoman for U.S. U.S. Central Command, declined to comment when told about the Taliban claim. She earlier acknowledged American military officials were investigating reports of a crash. The spokesman of the Ghazni province, Arif Nouri, earlier told Agence France Press News Agency that a plane crashed around 1:10 in the afternoon local time in the Deyak district. A police spokesman in the province also confirmed the crash, but was also unable to identify the craft. Large swaths in the rural region or areas in Ghazni province are controlled or under the influence of Taliban militants, making access to the area difficult for officials. And social media was rife with suggestions that the plane was from the state-owned Ariana Afghan Airlines. However, the company said the rumors were not true. All the flights of Ariana Afghan Airlines have been completely normal, a statement on the carrier's verified Facebook page had read. And crashes involving military flights, particularly helicopters, are common in Afghanistan, where inclement weather and creaky aircraft are often pressed to their limits in the war-torn country, where insurgents have been known to target helicopters. The last civilian flights to crash was in May of 2010, when an aging Pamir Airways plane went down in bad weather during a scheduled flight to Kabul from the northern province of Kunduz. It was carrying 6 crew and 38 passengers when it crashed into a mountainside about 12 miles from Kabul. So, very, very compelling situation that goes on. Now, this is also very interesting. The China coronavirus threatens Asia's tourism industry. Seems that a deadly virus, a virus that has prompted travel restrictions in China, is sending shockwaves through Asia's tourism industry, which has become increasingly reliant on growing numbers of Chinese visitors. At least 81 people have died since the new strain of coronavirus and emerged in China's Wuhan, the city of Wuhan and the adjoining areas, and millions are now under an effective quarantine. All flights in and out of the city grounded, and the ban on Chinese tour groups domestically and abroad. The measures come amid a boom in Chinese foreign travel, with the number of tourists from the country increasing nearly tenfold since 2003, according to a report by research firm Capital Economics. But businesses and destinations that rely on the huge numbers of Chinese tourists are already feeling the heat, with complaints of deserted beaches and shops, and concerns about the future. There will be less immediate impact in Europe, which is currently off peak season for visitors from China. The outbreak carries echoes of the SARS crisis, which paralyzed regional travel and battered local economies from late 2002. Chinese tourist numbers then fell by around a third at that time. If they fell by a similar amount again, it would knock around 1.5 to 2 percentage points from the gross domestic product in the most vulnerable countries, Capital Economics said. In Japan, the fall in Chinese visitors was already being felt in Akasuka, a popular tourist destination near the Sensoji Temple. We've definitely been seeing less people this year, said Yoshi Yonayama, 31, the manager of a shop selling traditional Japanese sweets and a rice-based drink called amazake. I think there are less than half of the numbers of last year or the year before, she told Agence France Press. The number of Chinese holidaying in China has exploded from around 450,000 in 2003 to 8.4 million in 2018, accounting for 27% of all inbound tourists as Tokyo works to expand the sector. But it will now be very difficult for Japan to achieve its target of 40 million tourists in 2020. Yuki Takashima, an economist at Nomura, Securities told Agence France-Presse, and the effects will be felt beyond hotels, restaurants, and tourist sites because many Chinese tourists visit Japan specifically to shop. The crisis has already sent Japan's key Nikkei index plunging, with stock in Shiseido, a cosmetics brand popular with Chinese tourists, falling more than 5% on Monday. We can expect those stocks to continue to fall like dominoes, said Stephen Innes, the chief market strategist at Oxyport. But he said that Japan would be better placed to weather the storm than another top destination for Chinese tourists, that specifically being Thailand. Tourism accounts for 18% of the nation's gross domestic product, with Chinese holidaymakers making up more than a quarter of total arrivals. Well, the country's tourism industry or minister has already warned a crisis on the scale of SARS could cost an estimated $1.6 billion, and the effects are already clear in a place called Phuket. For 2 days, the streets, the shops, and the beaches have been deserted, said Claude de Crisset, who owns a 40-room hotel and a restaurant on the island. Phuket has focused almost exclusively on Chinese tourism. If the situation continues, we will all be impacted. Now, Australia, too, already reeling from the effects of the bushfire crisis, is likely to feel the impact. Chinese visitor numbers doubled in the 6 years to June 2019, with mainlanders now accounting for 15% of Australia's inbound tourists. Mario Hardy, the CEO of the Pacific Asia Travel Association, PATA, said it was hard to gauge how long the crisis would last. I would suspect the impact would be between 3 to 6 months, but it will really depend on how the situation evolves in the coming weeks. Well, the impact will be felt less immediately in Europe, which does not attract as many visitors from China during the winter. We are now in low season for now. But if the situation persists, the economic impact will be significant, said Jean-Marie Mas, the head of the French Travel Lobby Group. And last month, more than 2 million Chinese tourists visited France, the most popular destination in Europe, staying an average of 5 days and spending a collective 4 billion euros. A Swiss tourism official said they also expected a decline in bookings from China, which makes up 4.5% of all hotel night bookings. Now, Kurt Jansson, the director of Britain's Tourism Alliance, said Chinese visitors to the United Kingdom represent less than 2% of the annual total, so there will not be any significant overall impact. Oh, my goodness. Things happen, right? And let's see what's going on here. Evidently, Muqtada al-Sadr, a symbol of anti-U.S. resistance in Iraq, was interviewed and says, for months, Iraq has been rocked by anti-government demonstrations and now a crisis between the United States and Iran. And one man stands in the center or at the center of these events, Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric, who was the big winner of the 2018 legislative elections. It seems that hundreds of thousands gathered on January 24 to protest American troop presence in Iraq at the call of Muqtada al-Sadr. Muqtada al-Sadr is a symbol of resistance. He is famous for having resisted the Americans and the Islamic State in Iraq. With him, Iraq belongs to the Iraqis, said one protester, Saad al-Dakhlaki. Well, a nationalist and a reformist, Sadr told today leads the majority bloc in parliament with its stronghold in Sadr City, east of the capital of Baghdad. Each street corner in Sadr City displays the portrait of the Shiite cleric, flanked by his father and his stepfather, all considered to be descendants of Prophet Muhammad. In the 2000s, Sadr also distinguished himself as a warlord fighting against the occupying American forces. But his detractors accuse him of incessant reversals and political opportunism after initially supporting anti-government protests. Sadr has recently distanced himself from the movement since the American strike against General Hassan Soleimani, Satter and his supporters have made the fight against the United States their priority. The Americans are our greatest enemy. Today, the peace brigades are ready to take up arms and will fight if Muqtada al-Sadr asks them. All honorable Iraqis should request that they leave, said the highest tribal authority in Sadr City, Sheikh Nafah al-Atwani. So, definitely major, major crisis. This is very interesting as well. Billie Eilish evidently sweeps the Grammys, winning all four top awards. Teen sensation Billie Eilish swept the Grammy Awards on Sunday, winning all four top prizes, album, song, record of the year, and best new artist, in a rare feat at the music industry's highest honors. Eilish is an 18-year-old newcomer with a unique sound, one for her debut studio album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? And while her hit single, Bad Guy, was named Record of the Year and Song of the Year, and all it took home five awards. She's only the second person and the youngest to win all four top Grammys on the same night. Eilish, distinguished by her green hair and baggy clothes, recorded the album with her brother Phineas in the bedroom of their Los Angeles home. Phineas also won the Grammy for Non-Classical Product of the Year or Producer of the Year. So they seemed taken aback by their Grammy haul, which saw them triumph over established stars, including Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande, and rapper Post Malone. So very compelling, to say the least. Bear with me a moment as we move forward. One second. And this is important as well. Evidently, three rockets hit the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad as thousands protest across Iraq. Seems that three rockets slammed into the U.S. Embassy in Iraq's capital on Sunday in the first direct hit reported after months of close calls as thousands of protesters kept up anti-government sit-ins and across the country. The attack marked a dangerous escalation in the spree of rocket attacks in recent months that have targeted the embassy or Iraqi military bases where American troops are deployed, and none of the attacks have been claimed, but Washington has repeatedly blamed Iran-backed military factions in Iraq. On Sunday, one rocket hit an embassy cafeteria at dinner time, while two others landed nearby. And a senior Iraqi official said at least one person was wounded, but it was not immediately clear how serious the injuries were and whether the person was an American national or an Iraqi staff member working at the mission. The U.S. Embassy did not immediately respond to requests for a comment. And the U.S. State Department called on Iraq last Sunday to fulfill the obligations to protect our diplomatic facilities. And the attack took place earlier in the day than usual. So I want to go back to something else with you, and bear with me a moment. I want to just go to the top of our screen here. This is interesting. We touched on this issue with Michael Edelman. Evidently, the Palestinians are calling on the world to reject the Trump peace plan. So out of Ramallah, we hear that the Palestinians today urged world powers to reject Donald Trump's peace plan, which they said President Mahmoud Abbas had refused to discuss with his U.S. counterpart despite several outreaches. In other words, the president did call out to him, but he refuses to take the call. Trump is due to unveil his proposal for Middle East peace this week in Washington. We expect it tomorrow, where he is scheduled to meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and opposition leader Benny Gantz. Well, Palestinian leaders who have not been invited to the White House have already rejected the U.S. initiative and insist that Trump's administration has forfeited its role as an honest broker in the conflict due to what they say is the president's pro-Israeli pro-Israel bias. Quote, we call on the international community to not be partners in this plan because it contravenes international law. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh told journalists ahead of a weekly cabinet meeting. The details of Trump's initiative, which has been in the works since 2017, are not yet public. But his administration has already recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the Jewish state captured from Syria in the Six-Day War of 1967, and stopped referring to the West Bank as occupied territory. It also no longer considers Israeli settlements there as inconsistent with international law, and most analysts expect his proposal to reaffirm his administration's positions. Trump also broke into with decades of international consensus where the fate of Jerusalem should be negotiated between parties when he recognized a disputed city as Israel's capital in December 2017. He is releasing the plan as he faces impeachment hearings over abuse of office while Netanyahu battles serious corruption charges during a neck-and-neck election against Gantz. This is a plan to protect Trump from impeachment and prevent Netanyahu to protect Netanyahu from prison. It is not a Middle East peace plan, Shtayyeh told a cabinet meeting. Previously released parts of the Trump initiative support, or rather purport to offer the Palestinians substantial economic incentives. The rights of the Palestinian people are not for sale, Shtayyeh had said. This plan gives Israel sovereignty and Palestinian territory. Well, Trump has repeatedly cast himself as the most pro-Israel American president in history, and his plan is expected to be the life of the for the Jewish state, even proposed by the American leader. So three Palestinian officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, told Agence France-Presse its leanings toward unfortunately I lost space here. So in Gaza on Monday, a few hundred Palestinians protested against the Trump plan, which Palestinians ironically call the deal of the century. So further protests were expected on Wednesday, when the plan is expected to be public, either Tuesday or Wednesday. So we'll have to see where that goes. All right, let me quickly look here. Wanted to cover some things on the local arena for you. Bear with me a moment. And this is an article that was posted last night, written by Richard Brodsky, the former assemblyman representing Hastings and parts of Greenberg, which is a part of Greenberg, actually, and parts of Yonkers. It says, two of the New York sacred cows are about to lock horns, writes Richard Brodsky. Well, what's different about this year's budget proposal from Governor Andrew Cuomo has nothing to do with the size of the looming $6 billion budget gap. Albany has successfully wrestled with large gaps before and often. The problem is that for the first time, we're headed for a collision between the two sacred cows of state government. This budget pits health care spending against economic spending. It's not a long time coming, and the results will not be pretty. Now, healthcare spending has been increasing at a strong rate. Two dynamics are driving this. First, we chose two vastly separate services, including long-term care and home care, and to vastly expand the number of New Yorkers eligible for subsidized states, mostly because of Obamacare. As a result, evidently 95% of New Yorkers now have access to health care, so something to be proud of. Second, we chose to subsidize rural health care facilities in ways that are not socially defensible but very expensive. Small town hospital clinics, nursing homes, and what networks are operating at high cost. We rightly want care available within a reasonable time and distance, and see that as the future. So that's the story with us. Thank you for being with us today. Just going to quickly look. I don't remember who we have scheduled for tomorrow. We're going to speak to A.J. Smith. He is the Vice President of Financial Education. And so we're going to speak to him tomorrow. He'll be on from 11 to 11:30. And then from 11:30 to 12, we have Sean Patterson Howard. And from 10 in the morning to 11, I'll be covering the international and domestic news. So that's our story for today. Thanks for being with us. All the best to you. And so what I'll do is I'll go back to our studio screen and simply say goodbye. Goodbye.